From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At this moment, members of Congress are debating the articles of impeachment against President Trump, preparing to vote, then formally deliver those articles to the Republican-controlled Senate in a somber ritual that starts only the third Senate impeachment trial of a president in U.S. history. Here's Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler, Democrat from New York, named this morning by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi as one of the impeachment managers or prosecutors, speaking today on the House floor.
The Senate is on trial. We will see whether they conduct a fair trial and allow the witnesses or conduct a cover-up. Today's resolution is the next step in the serious and solemn constitutional process. I urge my colleagues to vote yes on the resolution.
Gentlemen.
NPR's Kelsey Snell is on Capitol Hill. Kelsey probably setting up a cot because this could be a long historic time. And by the way, Tanya and I are going to double team you today with questions. Tanya's going to be up in a minute. But I wanted to start with what's happening now. Does it feel historic?
Well, right now, the House is debating the naming of the managers and the process of basically passing a resolution to send the articles of impeachment over to the Senate. And it does feel like a change here. There is a palpable tension, particularly in the Senate, where they are scrambling to try to set up all of the logistics for this to happen, because this isn't just going to be a normal several weeks here in the Senate. There will be all new rules for what the senators can and cannot do. They're not going to be allowed to bring in outside reading material onto the floor. They're advised not to even have side conversations with the person sitting next to them. They will have a box where they'll have to put their phones before they go into the floor. And reporters are preparing for our own set of new rules. This is a definite change to the normal way of things up here on Capitol Hill.
It's like you go in a courtroom.
Yes.
And you know, after the House vote that Jerry Nadler referred to, of course expected to pass along party lines, the process is then in Mitch McConnell's hands, a trial starting Tuesday. Now, even Republicans who want witnesses, such as Mitt Romney, say calls for witnesses we'll wait till after the trial formally starts. So sketch that out for us. What does that look like?
Well, Republicans say that the calls will have to wait, but Democrats will have an opportunity to bring up the witness question likely on Tuesday sometime. We expect that they're going to try to amend this thing called the McConnell resolution, and that is the basic outline for how the trial will go forward. This is the thing where when we often hear them talking about rules that were passed unanimously under during the Clinton trial, this is the type of rule that we're talking about. It tells them how long each side has to make their case, how long senators have to write questions and submit them. It's quite a little process there. But during that time, before they can even vote on that, Democrats want them to vote on whether or not witnesses will be allowed, and that'll be done in the form of amendments to the resolution. So be prepared to see the witness fight play out more than once.
And of course, the difference with the Clinton trial, we've said this before, is that during the Clinton impeachment, all of the witnesses, you know, that were allowed, whereas President Trump has not allowed witnesses to come forward in the previous process in the House. And so now there's a hunger to get them. But yesterday we heard Mitch McConnell. He was asked if he'd called Hunter Biden. He seemed to say, well, if the Democrats, they won't be the only ones calling witnesses. So that could heat up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We know that Nancy Pelosi delayed the start of this trial by refusing to name the impeachment managers or formally hand over this process to the Senate until she thought she was sure the trial would be fair. Where has this fallen politically, do you think, for each side?
Well, Pelosi says that she achieved what she wanted to achieve with the delay. She says that she was able to focus the public attention on the questions of witnesses and evidence. And some Democrats think that that prolonged discussion about the Senate rules forced some Republicans into agreeing that witnesses and evidence should be allowed. Whether or not it actually plays out that way is still an open question. Now, Republicans say all of this was pointless and they could have had this conversation about witnesses and evidence in the Senate without a delay like this.
Yeah. And just in the few seconds before I turn it over to Tanya Mosley, do we know if the president is watching? Is there a sense that his aides are telling him, please don't tweet during your own trial? You know, what's the sense of what might happen?
Well, the president has tweeted about witnesses, and he has weighed in saying that, you know, that the trial should be dismissed, that he has thoughts about these things. We don't know how much he's going to be watching the trial itself. I think that'll be something that we'll be watching for sure.
Yeah, NPR's Kelsey Snell. Take it away, Tanya.
Thank you, Robin. Hey, Kelsey. I want to take a closer look at those seven House impeachment managers announced today and what their roles will be. Can you first tick through who they are?
Sure. So there are seven. There is Adam Schiff, who is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Gerald Nadler, who is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Akeem Jeffries, who is the chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, Jason Crow, a congressman from Colorado, Val Demings, congresswoman of Florida, Sylvia Garcia of Texas, and I'm missing someone, Zoe Lofgren, California. Lofgren. So they, yeah. It's a long list. I think the thing that we need to remember here is it's a combination of leadership folks and people who are bringing in prosecutorial expertise. And that is exactly what Pelosi said she wants. She wants people who can conduct a trial.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit more from Speaker Pelosi on why she chose those managers who kind of serve like prosecutors.
The emphasis is on litigators. The emphasis is on comfort level in the courtroom. The emphasis is making the strongest possible case to protect and defend our Constitution.
But Kelsey, there's something else. Some wanted Pelosi to choose independent Congressman Justin Amash as a manager to make the process less partisan. She did not do that, of course. What do you make of her choices?
She chose people who represent the House case as it was presented in the Intelligence Committee and in the Judiciary Committee. She chose people that represent individual parts of that. You know, people who can send a message about who Democrats are and why they are impeaching this president. Mm-hmm. Having Amash there was something that leadership aides dismissed from the moment that that small group started bringing it up, just because this is about Democrats making their case, not necessarily about bringing in Amash to do that for them.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. These managers are in charge of carrying the articles of impeachment over to the Senate. What specifically will they do over the next few days?
Well, first, they will have to, as you said, carry it directly to the Senate, physically carry it. And then they will have the responsibility of reading the articles into the Senate record. And then they will be the people who are in charge of making the House case in the Senate. So we expect that there will be about 24 hours of testimony time devoted to those House managers arguing the case against the president. And then the White House will have the same amount of time to argue their case. And those impeachment managers will be the ones who do the talking then.
And so will this feel very much like a courtroom? What will prosecuting this case entail? Would they question witnesses, which has been an ongoing question for the last few weeks?
This isn't going to be like watching Law and Order. I think that we should expect that it's going to be a very, very stoic process. I don't think that we're going to see a lot of outbursts. It's a situation where the senators themselves are required to be silent. So this is not going to the fireworks that we saw throughout the process in the House are not going to be replicated in the Senate if people follow the rules.
Okay. We've also been reminded this week that one of the House managers during Clinton's impeachment, former Republican Congressman James Rogan, lost re-election to Congressman Adam Schiff after the Clinton impeachment. From your view, what are the larger political ramifications for these managers really accepting this responsibility?
Well, I think that the political ramifications stretch even beyond the managers themselves. For the managers, a lot of them are in safe Democratic districts at this point. And they, as I talked to Democratic staffs, they feel that these people are pretty safe politically. The greater political question also kind of looks at the timeline. We're going to be in the middle of an impeachment trial during the State of the Union and as Democratic voters are casting their first ballots in the primary in Iowa. That is a really, really big moment.
Yeah.
And it's a situation where both sides could either benefit or could really see drawbacks depending upon how these arguments play out and how they are received.
Yes, you have a busy day ahead. You talked a little bit with Robin about what you'll be doing over the next few hours, but this is really unprecedented.
Sure. This is not something that most people up here in the Capitol have experienced. Zoe Lofgren, one of the impeachment managers, is one of the very few people in the Capitol who has been here for three impeachment trials now. She was on the Judiciary Committee staff during Nixon. She was present here as a House member during Clinton, and she is now an impeachment manager for Trump. So this is again, a moment that not many people in the Capitol or in Washington in general have experienced.
Yes, we'll definitely be watching as it happens and learning as it happens. As you mentioned, many of us, this is the first time that we're actually watching it in this way. The Clinton impeachment, of course, happened long ago, where many of us may not remember those key points and details of what happens in an impeachment process. That's NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Let's take stock of this fire hose of a news day, shall we? Formal proceedings to start the impeachment trial against President Trump. A trade deal signed. The buzz over whether Elizabeth Warren refused to shake Bernie Sanders' hand after last night's Democratic candidates debate. It sure looked like it. Remember, Sanders was asked if he told Warren that a woman couldn't be president. He said, absolutely not. She didn't say what he said, but pivoted off that moment with one of the most memorable lines of the CNN Des Moines Register debate.
So, can a woman beat Donald Trump? Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women. Amy
so
and
true.
Me.
Let's bring in our political strategist, Alice Stewart, the Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Busy day.
Yes. Bill Press, the Democrat who hosts the Bill Press podcast. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Robin.
And Bill, I want you to start with that moment because Sanders was asked by the CNN moderator, Abby Phillips, on whether he did say this. He said, absolutely not. Then she turned to Warren and said, what did you think when he said this? Which he just said he didn't. Was that a missed moment there? You know, not asking Elizabeth Warren to directly ask or point to Bernie Sanders and say, you said this. Was that odd?
Even if she had asked that question, I don't think Elizabeth Warren would have fallen for the bait. Look, as a Democrat, I was alarmed a little bit that and disappointed that before the debate, they were just tearing at each other instead of tearing at Donald Trump. I think they wisely made the decision they were not going to let the moderators goad them into having that cat fight, if you will, on the stage. But I thought she handled it. Look, I'm not sure there was any knockout winner last night, but if there was, I believe it was Elizabeth Warren because she pivoted right to the fact that the question here is not whether he said, she said, whatever. Let's not get into that. A woman can win. And if you look at the record of the people on the stage, these men have lost 10 elections. Boom. End of story.
Mic drop.
She did very well.
The reality is this is a he said, she said situation. And let's be honest. Elizabeth Warren has had trouble with the truth in the past. Her ancestry topping the list of many things she has been factually challenged on. So I think the fact that we're debating and asking direct questions about a very confidential conversation is questionable. And there she should have had the opportunity, if she's going to allow her campaign to leak out something so damaging to someone, she needs to have the courage to look him in the eye and address it directly on the debate stage. And she did not do that.
She did so shortly by saying, I told him I disagreed. So she did not. She did not say, no, I agree now that he
Bill,
never said that. She just said,
may I
make one quick
yes,
point?
Yes, I was going to ask if you wanted to respond to the Native American heritage, but go ahead.
I think that's been resolved. It's not an issue, frankly. But I want to go back to when I first talked to Bernie Sanders in March of 2014 about maybe running for the president, what that was all about. Bernie told me he wanted to get those progressive ideas and make sure they were part of the primary, Democratic primary in 2016. And he said, he told me he had talked to Elizabeth Warren and thought maybe she might run, encouraged her to do so, and indicated if she did, he would have supported her. But if she did not, he would probably consider running. Mm. So, I don't know who said what in that dinner meeting in 2018. All I'm saying is I think Bernie's got a record. I'm just glad, I hope that that's behind us. Focus on Donald Trump. That's what it's all about.
All right. Well, let's look forward and do that. Alice, Joe Biden is getting a lot of points for last night. One moment. Bernie Sanders had also said that one of Biden's weak points and he said it last night, was his vote for the Iraq War. Bernie Sanders, of course, did not vote for the Iraq War. Biden was asked about that. Let's listen.
I said 13 years ago it was a mistake to give the president the authority to go to war if, in fact, he couldn't get inspectors into Iraq to stop what thought to be the attempt to get a nuclear weapon. It was a mistake, and I acknowledge that. But right out, the man who also argued against that war, Barack Obama, picked me to be his vice president. And once we were elected president, he turned to me and asked me to end that war.
You know, Alice, it was a little refreshing to hear someone on a national stage admit they made a mistake.
Absolutely. Look, Bernie Sanders was correct on that vote. Joe Biden was incorrect. And kudos to him for stepping out in front of that, acknowledging that he made a mistake, and moving on. Look, we all benefit from hindsight, looking back as to all the people that voted for that, including Hillary Clinton, for that matter. But he acknowledged this and took this as an opportunity to make the case for himself with his experience as vice president, being a forceful leader on foreign policy, but then also making the case to the people there in Iowa about how he plans to take his message directly to Donald Trump and bring about a call for unity.
And I've got to say that I think Joe Biden did the right thing. He apologized. It was the wrong vote. It was the wrong vote for Hillary Clinton, too. But, you know, I got to say, I am tired of some Democrats making this the issue, something that a vote 18 years ago. I mean, let's move on. Well, and I don't think Democrats should have to pay the price for George Bush's war.
Well, they even went back 30 years at one point, and that brings me to Pete Buttigieg, who, you know, at one point I was watching and I thought, wow, he looks awfully young, you know, when they're talking about something that happened 30 years ago. And I'm wondering if that's a plus or a minus for either of you. But he did seem to fade from the conversation, then made this argument on electability. Let's listen.
I'm ready to take on Donald Trump because when he gets to the tough talk and the chest thumping, he'll have to stand next to an American war veteran and explain how he pretended bone spurs made him ineligible to serve. And if he keeps trying,
of course, and that veteran is him, Alice.
That was an excellent point. And for him to have that contrast with this president, with foreign policy being such a huge topic last night and on the forefront of the news, that is an excellent contrast for him to make. And he should. He should use his military experience as an asset when he is showing a contrast with the president, but as well those on the stage. And I thought that was a good moment.
I have to agree that Pete Buttigieg had a good night. That was his best moment, I believe. But I also want to say, I think when you look at the people the six who were on stage last night, foreign policy did dominate. And there's one person on stage who has extraordinary and long experience in foreign policy, and that is Joe Biden. Yeah. And so I think that worked to Joe Biden's advantage.
Just real quick, because I'm sorry, Alice, I just want to get on so many other things. So I want to ask Amy Klobuchar, she needed a breakout moment. And then Tom Steyer went full bore on climate change. Did either of them do what they needed to do?
Amy Klobuchar was the best on that stage with regard to connecting with the people of Iowa. And when you're starting your closing argument 3 weeks out from the Iowa caucus, those people in Iowa want you to be on the national stage, but they want you to talk to them. And she gave names, she gave places and faces of people she has met on the campaign trail. And that goes a long way to being able to connect with them, because that is what they will be doing for the next few weeks, is pressing the flesh with these candidates. And they want to see someone that connects with them. And I think she did a tremendous job with that.
Yeah. And I have to add that I think we're down to the final five. I think there were five serious candidates on stage last night. And then there was also Tom Steyer, who happened to be there. Yeah. But not to be too cruel there, but that's a fact. But Amy Klobuchar, she didn't have as good night last night, I believe, as she had before. But I've just wrote a column about Amy Klobuchar. Watch Amy Klobuchar. She could be the closer here, or the dark horse or whatever. She's a moderate. She's very good on her feet. She's got a good record. She's from flyover country, right? She can deliver, I think, in that. She's proven she can deliver and get a lot of Republican votes.
Let's see what happens.
She's worth watching.
Well, speaking of Iowa, there was a poll that we didn't think got enough attention last week. It was from the Democratic polling firm Public Policy Polling. It shows Donald Trump with a marginal lead, you know, 3 points, 2 points, error of margin, over the top four Democrats. He signed a trade deal with China today. It looks like his trade deal with Mexico and Canada will make it through Congress this week. You know, your sense, I mean, in fact, it was interesting to watch the split screens. Fox News carried this entire signing of the China deal where he called out everybody who was in the audience there, every Republican, it seemed like Alice in Washington, while watching CNN, they were getting ready for the impeachment or the impeachment vote in Congress. Your sense of where Donald Trump is right now?
That point with regard to making progress on trade with China as well as the USMCA, that will go a long way, especially in a state like Iowa. That is a huge agriculture state. They need to sell their soybeans. They need to sell their products. And the trade deal with China as well as with Canada and Mexico will help. It's a huge victory for American workers, but also for farmers. And that, in addition to the unemployment numbers are at a great point, the Dow is rebounding, and we have wage growth is also on the way up. Those factors, the economic factors, will be a big bonus for the president in a state like Iowa.
Yeah, and two quick points. One is, let's not forget that a lot of farmers have really suffered under Donald Trump's sanctions, particularly the soybean growers, and it's unsure that these trade deals will bring them back. But I have to say, I think the trade is a good issue for Donald Trump. Let's remember, it's Democrats who forever opposed NAFTA, who opposed the Pacific, the TPP last year, and have said that these trade deals are unfair to American workers and don't protect the environment. And so I think this is one rare case where Donald Trump is doing, in many ways, what the Democrats have been asking for a long time.
And the Democrats are praising him for the progress that he has made on trade.
Timing.
Got it.
That's Alice Stewart, Republican strategist Bill Press, the Democrat, who also hosts the Bill Press podcast. Look, just thank you for continuing to look at this with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
On Friday, the House Antitrust Subcommittee will continue its investigation into the tech industry with testimony from four executives who say companies like Google and Amazon are not playing fair. One of them will be Patrick Spence, CEO of the digital speaker company Sonos. Last week, Sonos sued Google, alleging the company infringed on its patents when it developed its own smart speakers. Their case is the latest in front of a growing battle for oxygen in a business increasingly dominated by a few giant companies. Let's bring in Mark Bergen. He covers tech for Bloomberg News. Mark, what exactly is Sonos alleging in their lawsuit?
So the lawsuit specifies that Google, going back in 2013, they had a partnership with Sonos around Google's music service. And then Sonos said starting in 2015, Google began blatantly kind of infringing on the patents that Sonos has to develop their own speaker system. They told the New York Times that they believe that Google, as well as Amazon, may have infringed on up to 100 different patents that Sonos owns.
So it was a break for Sonos in 2013 when they got to work with Google. Now the company's executives are saying that they were possibly naive. But really, it begs the question, did they have any other option than to work with Google?
Right. That's a difficult question. Right? You know, they went back and said in 2013, Google, it was working on a music player. There was no indication that Google was going to put out a smart speaker competing with Sonos. And that was before the Amazon had also put out the Echo and a year later. And so, you know, at that point, Sonos was thinking that this was, you know, Google had been was a key partner here. They were kind of new and early in this music space. And this great way for Sonos to deliver this more value for a customer working with this big company and not seeing that they would down the line become an immediate competitor and not seeing that both Google and Amazon would put out speakers and then discount them really sharply. That's the main case that Sonos is arguing, is that they have these much larger companies that are basically putting out these speakers at really cheap prices because they have profitable businesses that can kind of subsidize cheaper products and undercut Sonos in the market.
Can you go more into what Google's defense is exactly?
So their defense so far is that they developed their own speaker system. And in 2015, Google put out what they call the Google Home, which is this voice-activated speaker. So that's the difference between what Amazon and Google put out. They're offering to consumers is that, hey, you can use these speakers and activate your voice. Sonos at that point didn't have the offering. They've since partnered with both Amazon and Google. And so in a way, you know, my boss Brad Stone called them seedlings, C-E-D-E. Like these are companies, Sonos example, that once at one time was dominating this market and now kind of seeded it to larger players and seen it slip away. And the argument they're making is that those Amazon and Google use kind of anti-competitive practices to get there.
I mean, your boss has a point. In some sense, the damage is already done. I mean, these guys dominate the smart speaker market. So what remedy is Sonos seeking exactly?
For sure. I mean, I think one outcome could be that they prove either in court or certainly with a settlement with Google that Sonos has valuable IP and that their technology is actually valuable and they can license it out to partners. And we've seen companies do that in the past where they sort of have these royalties. You know, the Roku is a good example. It was as early in the streaming wars. It's certainly now, you know, Netflix, Amazon, Apple are all coming in. But Roku has sort of turned and pivoted a bit and still find a niche that's pretty valuable. And there's a chance that Sonos could also find a niche in this market.
That's Mark Bergen, reporter for Bloomberg. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
In her press conference this morning, after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that 7 House impeachment managers will prosecute the case against President Trump, she referred to new evidence given to the House Intelligence Committee.
They released new evidence pursuant to a House subpoena, Lev Parnas, you know who that is, an associate of Rudy Giuliani, that further proves the president was a central player in the scheme to pressure Ukraine for his own benefit in the 2020 election.
That evidence includes a note handwritten by Lev Parnas on a Vienna Ritz-Carlton hotel pad referring to efforts to get Ukraine's president to investigate President Trump's political rival. It reads, "Get Zelensky to announce the Biden case will be investigated." Now, both Zelensky and announce are misspelled, but the point is clear. Philip Bump is national correspondent for The Washington Post. He's been looking at this new evidence. And Phil, you know, other than a reminder to check your spelling on notes to yourself because they may show up in a House investigative committee, what does this note mean to you?
Well, the note is part of a 4-page set of notes that appear to be Parnas taking notes as he was speaking with someone on the phone, presumably Giuliani, for whom he had done some work. And what the notes in total suggest is that there was an articulated plan to try and get more evidence that could potentially incriminate former Vice President Joe Biden to Donald Trump's benefit, and specifically that this was known as the outcome, that the notes lead with this idea that they want Zelensky to have an investigation into Biden is a very clear-cut example of what this process looked like, even though we already knew it existed because Trump himself made that request
in
July.
But actually, it's not even about the investigation. The note says, get Zelensky to announce that the Biden case will be investigated. It doesn't, you know, it's just the announcement. And we've heard that before as well. That made it seem even more political because you can have an investigation through the proper channels in the U.S. government. This was about an announcement which seemed even more partisan, more political. But we knew about that.
No, that's right. So Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, had made that same point in the impeachment trial, that he didn't know that they actually wanted an investigation, that they instead may have just been fine with an announcement. And if you look at what the aftermath of all of this discussion has been, essentially President Trump has gotten what he wanted, which is people talking about what may have happened with the Bidens in Ukraine. And while the allegations that Trump himself has made are unfounded, he has essentially gotten the equivalent of Ukraine making this announcement, which is scrutiny on someone who may be his 2020 opponent.
Right. Well, take us a step back. Lev Parnas, I mean, we've spoken about him before, but remind us, who is he? Why would he be taking notes from Rudy Giuliani?
So Parnas has a sort of an interesting relationship with Giuliani. He began working for him several years ago and was doing work. He was born in Ukraine. He speaks Russian. He was working as a translator for Giuliani as Giuliani engaged in this work in Ukraine. Back in the beginning of 2019, for example, Parnas was present as Giuliani was interviewing the former prosecutor general, Viktor Shokin, who's made all these allegations against Biden. Giuliani also acted as a lawyer for Parnas's business. But essentially what happened is Parnas was very close to Giuliani, had met with the president himself on occasion. And then all of a sudden last October, he gets arrested for alleged campaign finance violations. The information had already been requested of him by the House. But now with this arrest, he's decided to cooperate with authorities. And that included turning over this evidence to the House this week.
So this has been turned over. do we know beyond that what's taken place? What kind of talks might have taken place with House Democrats?
We don't know that at this point in time. Parnas has expressed repeatedly and publicly his interest in providing testimony. The Senate is not eager under Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's leadership to bring a lot of witnesses to come in and testify as part of the impeachment trial. It's very unlikely that Parnas would testify then. So it's not really clear beyond ongoing House investigations what that testimony might even look like.
Well, but even if things like these notes get into the public, they potentially impact, you know, at least the public view as the Senate trial begins. Talk about another new piece of evidence, a letter from Giuliani to then-President-elect Zelensky in Ukraine. This is before Giuliani was traveling to Ukraine. It reads, I am private counsel to President Donald J. Trump. Just to be precise, I represent him as a private citizen, not as president of the United States. He then continues, in my capacity as personal counsel to President Trump, and with his knowledge and consent, I request a meeting with you. A significant why?
Well, that with his knowledge and consent is particularly significant because it undercuts Donald Trump's assertions that he wasn't really aware of what Giuliani was doing when he first proposed going to Ukraine back in May of last year. Trump recognizes this is potentially problematic, tried to frame it as Giuliani simply going of his own volition. Maybe he had business interests in Ukraine. This letter suggests contemporaneously that Giuliani was doing so at Trump's behest.
Well, as you write, that notion that Rudy Giuliani is working for his client, Donald J. Trump, which makes them kind of a partnership, makes something that President Trump said in his own transcript of his conversation with now President of Ukraine, Zelensky, when he said, do us a favor, work with Giuliani, and not only investigate the Bidens, but investigate the Russian interference into my election. So he says, do us a favor. The president has said that us, and the president's supporters have said, us means the United States. What does us mean to you coupled with that letter?
Well, I mean, even independent of the letter, quite frankly, it's hard to believe that us is a reference to the United States. Trump often refers to himself in a sort of collective sense. He does it at his rallies. You know, we are winning all over the place, things along those lines. But that he recommends that Zelensky work with Rudy Giuliani itself gives the game away. Rudy Giuliani isn't a government employee. He doesn't work for the government. He works for Trump. And to ask the president of Ukraine to engage in an investigation in coordination with Donald Trump's personal attorney by itself suggests that this isn't something being undertaken on behalf of the American people.
You also have Rudy Giuliani saying just that to the New York Times. Before he went on this trip in May, he told the Times that he was asking Ukraine to do an investigation that they're doing already. And we know that there was an investigation going on into this prosecutor who was said not to be fully prosecuting things like the company that Joe Biden's son worked for. He was actually thought to be a corrupt prosecutor, which is why Joe Biden was representing many of the world leaders' opinions that that prosecutor should be removed. So, yeah, there was investigations, and Giuliani says, they're doing it anyway. I'm going to give them reasons why they shouldn't stop because that information will be very, very helpful to my client.
Yeah, exactly. So what Giuliani is presenting to the New York Times in that interview is that there are ongoing investigations into this company for which Joe Biden's son worked, and that whatever is uncovered as part of those investigations may be helpful to his client, Trump, on a personal level. It is extremely hard to take away anything from that other than that Rudy Giuliani recognizes that information which is derogatory about the Bidens will be useful to Trump on a personal basis. The response has broadly been, well, this is Rudy Giuliani just sort of talking and not necessarily representing an accurate relationship with the president. But again, those conversations are contemporaneous before any of the questions about Ukraine were raised, before Trump's conversation with Zelensky in late July. And as such, Giuliani went on to cancel his trip to Ukraine based on the outcry of questions about what he was doing, why he was doing it. All of this suggests that he was accurately representing his relationship with Trump at the time.
By the way, we should note that Giuliani said to the Times, that information will be very, very helpful to my client and may turn out to be helpful to my government. But it was an afterthought.
That's true.
Anything else that you're observing with some of this new information that's come in about Lev Parnas, about his giving information to the House as this impeachment trial starts?
Yeah, there's a potentially significant new development as well, which is that the then prosecutor general, the man who replaced the one who was accused of corruption, a guy named Yuri Lutsenko. Lutsenko had communications with Parnas in which he implied that in order for him to offer some information to Parnas about Biden, that the then ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, would need to be fired. That, of course, has been one of sort of the looming questions about all of this Ukraine stuff, is why Yovanovitch was a target of Trump's team and eventually was ousted by the Trump administration. This new evidence suggests that it was because Lutsenko said, hey, I have dirt on the Bidens, but unless Yovanovitch goes, I'm not giving it to you. That's obviously a paraphrase, but that is certainly a tantalizing hint about why Yovanovitch was such a target.
And where do you see that?
It's in messages in Russian that were translated, messages between Lutsenko and Parnas, including the documents.
That's Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Phil, thank you.
My pleasure.
A few weeks ago, I had a conversation on this program about research that found doctors prescribed Black Americans opioids less often because of racial bias. Further analysis found that nearly 14,000 lives were potentially spared because of this underprescribing. Many of you thought, and rightly so, that media reports on the study published in the medical journal Epidemiology framed this finding in a way that excuses racism. Others thought we on this show did not go deep enough on the harms of not being prescribed pain medications. We wanted to take a deeper look at this, and for that, we're joined by Utsa Khatri, an emergency medicine physician, and family nurse practitioner Shoshana Aronowitz. Both are first-year fellows at the National Clinician Scholars Program in Philadelphia. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
We're delighted to be speaking with you.
Dr. Khatri, I'll start with you. So much of the focus over the last few years has been on the tremendous amount of opioid deaths we've experienced in America, and much of that research is focused on white populations. But these latest findings bring up another issue, and this is about the harms of being underprescribed. Is it safe to say or safe to assume that Black patients that are underprescribed opioids end up living with unmanaged pain?
Yes, that is definitely safe to say. And I think it's important to talk about unmanaged pain separately from being under prescribed opioids. Black patients are undertreated in pain globally, whether that means opioid analgesics or non-opioid analgesics.
Shoshana, what are the long-term consequences of unmanaged pain?
There are many. People may have trouble engaging in healing activities like physical therapy. They may have trouble engaging with their families. And I think one of the most troubling possibilities is that people will attempt to self-manage pain. And this is especially risky now as the availability of counterfeit pills, so pills that look like oxycodone but are actually fentanyl, has increased.
And also, countless people have turned to a street supply of pain medication.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you something else, Dr. Khatri. There isn't a lot of information out there to help us understand how often non-opioid pain treatment is offered or used. We've had lots of conversations on this show about the harms of overprescribing. Less often do we hear about these alternative pain treatment options. What exactly are those options, and how effective are they in treating pain compared to opioids?
There are a lot of pharmacological and non-pharmacological pain regimens. And for many acute pain conditions, we often prescribe non-steroidals like ibuprofen. There are other medications like gabapentin that are good for treating more neuropathic pain. When we talk about non-pharmacological treatments, there's just not a good body of literature, at least that I'm aware of, yet. We know that patients anecdotally tell us that they have gotten a lot of relief from treatment regimens such as acupuncture, mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy. But in the healthcare system, we just haven't devoted enough of our resources to really study these treatment options head to head with some of the more pharmacological options we're used to.
And I'll just add, We know that physical therapy and acupuncture can be really helpful for patients, but a big issue for a lot of people is access. So they may not be able to afford the treatments, they may not be covered by their insurance, or maybe the treatments aren't available in the place they live and they're unable to travel to a provider.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, you know, in the context of this conversation, we're talking about a study that showed that racial bias is the reason that we're seeing these disparities. How accessible then in that light are these alternatives to Black Americans who aren't prescribed opioids by their doctors? Do we see more often that these doctors are offering alternatives?
There is a little bit of research showing that Black Americans are less likely to use or have access to physical therapy or acupuncture, and there are disparities there as well.
I'll start with you, Shoshana. Where and how do we even begin to address this issue of untreated and unmanaged pain for Black Americans? I mean, I know this is a really big question because really what we're asking is how do we even address racial bias in medical treatment?
The biggest issue I think here is the narrative that there's any sort of upshot to racism in healthcare. And I think specifically when we're talking about opioid prescribing, you know, first, this ignores how much damage racism in healthcare causes. But second, it really stigmatizes Black Americans who do suffer from opioid use disorder. It's almost like, what's your excuse? Hmm.
Dr. Khatri, your thoughts?
We know that these disparities exist both with pain treatment disparities as well as opioid use disorder treatment disparities. And when we have these conversations, we have to take targeted approaches to making sure we close them.
That's Utsa Khatri, an emergency medicine physician, and family nurse practitioner Shoshana Aronowitz. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. As we take stock of the state of spirituality, we're going to look at the internet and a site, for instance, that helps people through traumas.
Believe it or not, the ones who had the most positive outcome were not those who were receiving help, but the ones who were giving help to others.
Also, the latest on the impeachment of President Trump, next time here and now.